Follow me down this deep, dark hole.
And welcome to New Horror Express, your fortnightly podcast chatting to the best indie talent the horror genre has to offer. I'm your host, Scott Murphy, and on today's episode, I'm chatting to writer, director, actor, voiceover artist, and burlesque MC, Abe Goldfarb, about his directorial debut, The Horror at Gallery K. Now, this interview was recorded back in May, which is why there is a bunch of references to being in the middle of lockdown. So I thought I'd tell you that in case you were listening to it and got very confused about where we were going with that. Anyway, over the course of the interview, I talked to Abe about why he decided to bypass short filmmaking and dive in with a feature debut, how he shot the movie in only 11 days, and how he stretched out the film's micro budget. Plus, how he managed to balance his roles as the film's director, cinematographer, and editor. Away from the movie, we talk about Lovecraft's resurgence in popularity, how Abe got into acting, his role in Beetlejuice the Musical, and we both geek out over our joint love of Nicolas Cage. So, plenty to get to in the interview. I should warn you, though, that between minutes 7 and 10 on this particular interview, we do dive a little bit into politics. There is some kind of liberal ranting involved, and if you're not a fan of that, that's not up your street, that's fair enough, but just skip over it. Don't let it spoil this audio listening experience. Just skip over it. It'll be all good. Anyway, before we get on to the interview, I just want to quickly remind you the best way you can support New Horror Express is to rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify. But now, on to the interview with Abe.
Hi, Abe. Welcome to New Horror Express. Good to have you on the show.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me, Scott.
So we have you on today to talk about your directorial debut, The Horror at Gallery K.
Yes.
So for the listeners at home, can you give us a little spoiler-free synopsis of The Horror at Gallery K?
Sure. The Horror at Gallery K is about a relationship counseling session that goes either horribly wrong or horribly right, depending on your point of view. A couple, Olive and Petra, who have hit the skids, grown in different directions, make a last-ditch attempt to save their relationship by going into counseling with Petra's friend, Dr. Bozell. And through the session, it is revealed that there is a great and terrible secret lurking underneath not just this relationship, but the entirety of human existence. And I think that's all that I can say without giving much away. Yes. It's, a sort of H.P. Lovecraft's couples counseling is what it is, I think.
I mean, I've seen the movie. I mean, if I hadn't seen the movie, I would have said you sold me. But that's the premise. That's the premise I was all on board for.
It's the cleanest pitch I have is couples counseling with H.P. Lovecraft, minus the racism.
Minus. We always have to...
You have to qualify any discussion of H.P. Lovecraft by being like, except for the racist parts.
I've had a couple of conversations recently with film directors who have either been inspired by Lovecraft, and I actually talked to somebody recently who wrote a, a children's book based on the Cthulhu mythos.
Oh my gosh.
Would you know, it's actually quite a sweet children's book. It's
Lil Cthulhu. love that idea.
You'd be surprised. But yes, I have had these a bunch of conversations about Lovecraft recently, and on every episode that's come up, it's always been like, but not the racist parts.
Yeah. I mean, like, as a Jew, he would have hated me. I think, weirdly, we've reached a point where people are starting to claim the parts of that style and mythos that are enduring and good, and actually make works that are in dialogue with the problematic parts of Lovecraft's work. Like, the new Richard Stanley Color Out of Space, which is amazing, and I loved it. You know, it's basically your entire lens for the film is a black man, which would have been unthinkable for H.P. Lovecraft.
Absolutely. This is a question I've asked a few people, because it has come up again and again quite recently. Mm. And what is your take on why you think Lovecraft is in ascendancy right now? Well, you know, Mandy was directly inspired by Lovecraft.
Oh, no doubt.
Colors Out of Space. There's the new TV show coming, Lovecraft Country
from Jordan Peele. The amazing Jordan Peele.
To tackle it from that perspective of, like, tackling those problematic issues. So, again, that seems to be a thing as well of, like, taking on the mantle, but kind of deconstructing the racism within it.
Well, I think Jordan Peele's unique skill is, you know, utilizing classic horror tropes, but also interrogating them. I'm a huge fan of his stuff. And I'm the guy who thought Us was even better than Get Out, because it's so much more ambitious and strange. And, it leaves you considerably more unsettled than Get Out. It goes into much more ambiguous and scary thematic territory. But as for why Lovecraft is in the ascendance right now, at least his style, I really don't know. I mean, it could be that, horror does tend to go in cycles. Mm-hmm. You know, there are eras that take on certain tropes repetitively. I mean, I hesitate to make any sweeping statements about, like, you know, where we are as a society, but I do think there's something resonant and thrilling and terrifying about the idea of something that, if you truly understood it, would drive you insane. Like a horror that you can't actually comprehend. You know, cosmic horror is the most exciting thing to me, the idea that there are mysteries that mankind was never meant to unpack. When you're told a story like that, and it's a good story, it sort of teases at the edge of your brain, you know, long after you read or watch or listen to it. So I don't know why now, but I know why for me always, you know. And it could be that we need something that's not a slasher or a lank-haired vengeance ghost or, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah. I kind of don't want to go too sociological, but I did wonder, one of my things I've mentioned to other people, and I want to hear your take on it, is do you think it is uncertainty in the world is a factor in it? In the fact that there is a certain bleakness and to Lovecraft and the kind of madness that we're living in, political madness, pandemic madness now. And when you think about the last time Lovecraft was kind of in ascendancy in the 80s, the constant threat of nuclear war, this kind of throwing out of the kind of social democrat type of economic system for this kind of pure capitalism that was coming through, and this whole kind of change in the 80s, and there's uncertainty and bleakness.
Well, I think there's definitely something to that. I mean, you know, horror, any sort of era of horror cinema reflects the anxieties of that time. And I do think we're in a uniquely open-ended and uncertain time right now. Even before COVID-19 started spreading around the world, there was a sense that traditional orders were being disrupted. And that, speaking from the perspective of an American, obviously, who I think may have been a bit complacent during the Obama years and a bit hesitant to be engaged. I definitely had opinions, I had politics, but I don't think I was engaged as I should have been. because there was a hardening of a status quo that provoked a reaction, a burn it all down kind of reaction. And now we have the results of that in office here in America. Dissatisfied people, people with bigotries and fears who saw one chance at burning it all down. And now we live in a time and place where none of us have any idea what comes next. You know, from day to day, it's pretty scary. And I think that it's possible that the idea of a cosmic horror is something which exists beyond human comprehension. I mean, not to be glib, but I think there's more than a touch of Trump to that idea, this kind of extra dimensional, incomprehensible thing that doesn't correspond to any known logic. I don't know. Maybe I'm being glib. I'm not sure. But I do think that right now there's a sort of free-floating terror.
I think there is a lot of that in the world. And I think you see that in the politics of many countries, of this kind of chaos and throwing off of traditional orders or going back to older orders, whether it's in America or it's in the UK or it's in places like Brazil, Hungary, Turkey, Russia, all sorts of places. I don't want to get too political. People get very, I don't want people to shout at me on Twitter.
Yeah. You can make some judicious cuts.
Yeah, I know. Like, how did this become like a show? Well, I used to listen to this show, but now it's a show for libtards and snowflakes.
Speaking as an extreme libtard snowflake, I totally get what you're talking about.
Yes, absolutely. Just in case listeners at home were not aware, I am also a libtard snowflake. I apologize to anybody who upsets. Anyway, let's get back to the horror gallery K, because that's what we're going to talk about.
Yes.
How did you first come on board the project? Were you always on board the project, or did the script come to you? How did that process happen?
Here's what it was. I've written a bunch of screenplays, and all of them would have been pretty expensive to make. And I have no connections, really, as far as, you know, raising hundreds of thousands or even millions of dollars. And I was getting frustrated because I really, really wanted to make a film. And I just wasn't sure how. And I have a friend, Mac Rogers, who wrote The Horror Gallery K. He is one of the most extraordinarily brilliant playwrights that I've ever known. If you ever get the chance, you should try and find the Honeycomb trilogy, which is a domestic science fiction epic that he wrote for the stage back in 2012. And it's three plays that span decades during an alien invasion of Earth. And it is extraordinary. But I was always not just a friend, but a fan. And I got in touch with him and I said, hey, look, you keep getting your stuff optioned and it never gets made, which at that point was true. Now he's actually doing remarkably well in audio drama. He's been commissioned for so many things, deservedly. But at that point, he was frustrated because his plays would get optioned for films and they wouldn't get made. And I said, and I, you know, I can't seem to write something to the scale necessary here for me to be able to just make it. So I said, how about a play? How about a film, two locations, three speaking roles, and you write it and I'll make it, and that's that. And he was very excited by that, by the challenge of that. And over the course of the next few months, he would just write pages and send them to me. And I found myself really just amazingly intrigued by it. And I didn't really offer any guidance outside of the basic concept of like, what's the scariest thing is you wake up next to someone who you've known for years and you don't know them anymore. You know, they're just a different person. That was it. And then for months, he was just writing and writing and writing. And once we had a draft, I gave a couple notes. He made a few changes. I did a draft of my own, just going through it and streamlining it and moving some stuff around. And then we had a script. That was pretty much it. And then it was just down to us to figure out, how do we make this? And that was really a result of going to Brian Enck, another good friend who is sort of the chief guy at Third Lowe's Productions. And he loved the script dearly. And I said, well, how do we do this? And he said, well, we set start dates. And I said, you can't just set a start date. you can't just say we're making a movie now. And he was like, no, you can't. I mean, that's kind of how it happens. So we set a start date and we just made the thing. We shot it in, I think it was 7 days on the principal schedule and 2 evenings of pickup shots. And we had 2 days during the principal schedule of just lighting and set decorating. So I think all in all, you could say it was about 11 days.
Quick turnaround. How long were those days? Were they all like...
They were long.
Days.
They were very, very, very long days. I mean, we had shot lists, you know, we had stuff we needed to get done. You know, there was one day, it was tricky because we were working, certainly during the gallery sections, we were working in this space that there were difficulties. At one point there were workers a couple floors up playing music really loud. And then there was and that can, you know, mess with your sound recording, obviously. And then next door to us, there were these guys who were mixing hip hop. And, you know, listen, it's their space. And I'm the asshole if I'm like, hey, we're making a movie in here. You stop doing that. So, you know, we kind of had to work around a lot of these challenges. And so the days ran long. And there was the longest day was the one we basically, okay, so there was a day when we lost effectively half a day to sound issues. And I was convinced that we were going to not finish the film. And we were, I think, two or three days from the end. So, you know, we were well over half of the film had been shot. And so at that point, you know, the notion of not finishing becomes nightmarish. And my partner, Rosebud, who plays Olive, kind of dragged me up by the scruff of my neck because I was like, I came home that night and I was distraught that day that we had lost all that time. And basically they said, you know, listen, you can't not finish this. Everyone here is in it to win it and they believe in it and they believe in you. And we went in the next day and we shot, Jesus, I can't even remember how many setups we did that day. It must've been over 30, but we went, it must've been like a 16-hour day or something. But yeah, we got the shots. And so, you know, when you have that little time, it really is a question of either like, do we make it to the end or do we just give up? And I couldn't give up.
Were there any other on-set disasters, or was that the kind of the most challenging thing that happened?
Well, during the filming in the counselor's office, it turned out that a couple of people in the cast had allergic reactions to the cat that was owned by the person whose apartment it was, and so there were a couple of days of very, very uncomfortable, itchy, sneezy, exhausted shooting during what really was in theory the less strenuous of the two locations, but it turned out to be a bit of a struggle. And as far as another disaster, I mean, the last day of shooting, the reason we did pickups was because we lost the ability to shoot a particular part of the film. And we had to, okay, I'm probably talking all over myself. I hope any of this is coherent to the people who are listening, but you know, the scenes that are shot in the sort of zone, like in the where it's sort of all black, but the people's faces are sort of very harshly lit in the horror gallery, okay? Well, it was sort of this poetic idea that we came up with in the therapist's office during Petra's story. It was just, we found this really cool way of making it seem otherworldly and strange. And so the last day of shooting, we lost our ability to record sound because the people next door who were mixing music. And we had to shoot this sort of last conversation between Olive and Petra in the film before the climax. And we couldn't film it. And it had to be this really delicate, quiet, intimate scene. And we also didn't have the sequence in the waiting room at the beginning. And so we made this executive decision, which was just like, okay, we're not gonna do this and have to ADR the entire thing. In 2 weeks, we're all gonna get back together and we're gonna shoot this last conversation, but it's gonna be in that kind of inner space, in that weird zone. Because it was written to just be in the accepted reality of the film. And then I thought, nope, okay, we're gonna do this completely poetically and strangely, and hopefully it knits together with the rest of the film. And to my astonishment, it did. We made it to the end and we got the shots. And one night we shot that Olive and Petra conversation in front of just a black backdrop with a single source light. And then the next night we got the waiting room scenes, and somehow it works. I'm astonished. There are people who genuinely don't realize that it wasn't planned like that.
Interesting.
Yeah. But it's, you know, it's the thrill of problem solving, which is also the agony and terror of it all.
See, with the scenes like that, you know, the couple of glimpses into what you were calling the zone, things like that, the use of split screen, certain other, you know, kind of camera tricks that are used in the film. You mentioned that Mac was a playwright, and you know, it has that kind of vibe. But did you employ that kind of thing because you were conscious of not making the film look too stagey?
I do think that there was certainly an anxiety on my part that it not just feel like talking heads. And that's not due to any deficiency in the script. I mean, it's really exciting, beautiful language, but then it's on me to make it cinematic. You can't just plunk a camera down and say, here are some words. You have to visualize it. And it was partly a worry that people would get bored of people just talking, and partly the fact that I really love the films of Carol Reed, the films of Brian De Palma, and a lot of stuff in there is pretty direct homage. You know, there's a lot of those third man canted angles and low angles, and, you know, that De Palma split screen and some of that sort of swooning operatic, you know, spinning around kind of feeling.
It did make me think of De Palma, like particularly the split screens. I think maybe because I recently rewatched Sisters.
Oh, wow. Yeah. No, that movie owns. Yeah. De Palma's amazing. And I also think, again, like De Palma's a guy who people write off as a technician, but I think there's a deep seam of emotion in his films. I find them very, very moving and very personal, and thus very disturbing.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. With his best things, you know, I think there's an emotion. You know, if you look at things like his horrors as well as some of his gangster picks, you know, sure. Like. Yeah, like Carrie or Carlito's Way, or, you know, there's that.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm talking about the stuff that's sort of more stuff that's not really adapting a book or a real life story or whatever. I mean, like when De Palma would make something completely sort of personally generated, like Blowout, you know, where you really get a sense of like, this is a maniac at work on something that's obsessing him. You know, Blowout, Dressed to Kill, Body Double. Those are like maybe for me his sort of three key works.
I have to say, I've seen a lot of De Palma. I've not seen those three, and it's one of the three movies that are on the must-watch list that's like massive.
yeah. No, man, those three are incredible. And once you know about De Palma's life story, I mean, it becomes fascinating because people talk about the voyeuristic nature of De Palma's work. And yeah, I mean, he was, as a teenager, he basically surveilled his dad to find out if he was having an affair. He wanted to present his mom with proof. And so, like, you know, whenever you watch a De Palma film where you've got people, you know, watching furtively, either through surveillance equipment or in the shadows, and it's this really unsettling feeling, you're like, this is something he knows very well, this watching and this obsession. But
that's the kind of surveillance aspect as well.
I'm sorry, say again?
Sisters also has that.
Yes. Absolutely, yes. So yeah, De Palma was a huge influence, and Carol Reed being the other one. Stuff like The Fallen Idol and The Third Man, because I love black and white, and I love high contrast, and I love canted angles.
Two questions, one on the kind of camera work and one on the black and white. First one on the camera work. When did you come up with there's a great kind of visual gag where the camera is panning around the room.
Yes.
Rosebud plays Olive, says a certain line, and the camera pans back to her. And I found it one of the funniest moments in the movie.
I'm so glad you like that. Yeah, the 360 shot, which goes on for, I think it's almost 3 minutes, a shot that just goes round and round. Yeah, no, it was actually Patrick Shearer, my assistant director, and the guy who worked on the cinematography with me. The endless pan was something that I wanted to do because it reminded me of Blowout, And also I wanted to add a certain unsnappable tension to the scene, because it's when things really escalate into unpleasantness. But the pan back was Patrick's idea, and it was such a perfect cap to the scene. Like, honestly, the first time I saw it, I just cackled. And shooting that scene was absolute hell for the actors. I felt terrible for them, because it's 3 minutes of dialogue. Like, you're not, you know, you can't really fake it. You can't screw it up. You have to get through 3 minutes of dialogue and then have this little gag at the end. And I mean, they did it brilliantly.
How many?
But
that take?
I'm sorry?
How many takes?
I think it was 6 or 7 takes, and then we had it. But I remember that there was a lot of nervousness around that shot. But man, Patrick's gag at the end is, I love it. I love it so damn much. And it's a necessary release. I was so relieved that people found it funny. I mean, not just that shot, but the film. Because the film for me is very, very emotional and intense and sincere, but there's humor in it. And my great fear was that the humor wouldn't come through. But then, you know, we showed it for the first time, and at the screening, I mean, it was just raucous. And I was terrified that people weren't going to want to just sit and watch a bunch of people talk about their feelings for an hour and a half. But it turns out they really like that. And it's relatable, and it's funny, and it's freaky. And we did try in the filming to have a certain wit that hopefully doesn't feel super self-conscious.
I don't feel that it does. My other question was to do with the black and white. I asked your friend Adam Stovall, who I recently had on the show, the same question. Now, was the black and white artistic or budgetary decision? Obviously, you've stated that you do love black and white.
Yeah. For me, it was black and white from the beginning. I know that Adam shot in color and then found that he loved how black and white looked. And it works very well for Ghost Waits. I think it gives it a really fabulous look. We shot the entire film with the intention of just like, this is going to look like, even with cell phones or whatever, it's going to look kind of out of time, because the costumes don't feel particularly contemporary. And the style is perhaps a little more theatrical and less naturalistic in a lot of ways. So we from the beginning, we had the monitors set to black and white on the camera so we could just see how everything looked. And there's that little color section of the film, which was completely an accident. And again, I have to credit this to Patrick Shearer. This little flashback scene, because I had put it into the film, into my cut, as black and white. And when he loaded the footage into his system, it just sort of reverted to color. And he thought it was wonderful. And so once I saw it that way, with that break into color, it actually worked really, really well. And I loved the idea that the here and now is monochrome and a little bit menacing. And then like the back then is full color and kind of lush and swoony. And, you know, I love that. But yeah, black and white all the way. I love it. I love the way that it handles light. I love the way that it handles shape. I love what it forces you to do in terms of composition. It just changes your eye. And it enhances the experience that you're like watching a movie, because I'm not trying to convince anyone that this is real. For me, it's like, I want people to sit down and feel like they are watching a movie. And I love that.
Certainly a cinematic touch there for sure.
Yeah.
Going back a little before the actual shoot of the film, obviously you mentioned the Rosebud's your partner, but in terms of the other cast members, how quickly did you gather the cast? And obviously, because the majority of the film is only three people,
yeah,
obviously you had to be very, you know, even more careful about the chemistry that the cast have between each other. So
it was very, very important,
that process.
From the beginning, I knew that Rosebud was going to be Olive, and Mac and I had discussed who we wanted to do this, and so he was just writing for them. So Rosebud was, from the beginning, Olive. Brian Silliman. Well, Rosebud and I had met through burlesque, because I'm also a burlesque host for the last like 15 years. And that's how we met and got married. And Silliman and I had worked in theater for years. He wrote the book for Jonestown the Musical, which I was in a workshop of at one point, which is one of the craziest things I've ever been involved with. I directed a play of his called The Magic of Mrs. Crowling, which was a deranged sort of Harry Potter satire, and also very moving. And yeah, he'd acted in a production that I directed of Titus Andronicus, and I just love him, and I think he's one of the most brilliant actors I've ever met. And if I was going to make a movie, he had to be in it. Mac created that fourth character of the receptionist, and when he did, I thought, well, it's got to be Kristen Vaughn, who's another dear friend who I've seen in theater for ages and who I've had the pleasure and privilege of acting with. Just a perfect human being. Petra was a little more difficult because we had written it for a friend of ours who at a certain point quit acting while we were getting the project together. She's one of the most extraordinary actors I've ever seen. I don't want to name her, but I don't know if it would sound vindictive, or I don't know if she wants to be named or whatever, but she's amazing. And she retired from acting for very, very good reasons. You know, she had another path that she wanted to pursue, and I was utterly heartbroken and really tried to talk her back into it, and she wouldn't. And I totally respect that, because you got to do you. But it left us without a Petra. And again, we go back to the burlesque world. Maine Anders is a burlesque artist known as the main attraction. And I just had a feeling that she could do it. And I didn't even read her for it. I just offered her the role. And then we spent a few months of me just like going over to her place and us just working on cracking it. And it was definitely, it was difficult for both of us finding that language to collaborate with each other, that shared language. And then at a certain point, it just clicked. And once she was on set, I mean, give me a break. Her performance is amazing. Like she's breathtaking.
So is she, obviously she's the burlesque performance, the performer, you know, obviously has those skills, but she hadn't acted before.
No, she had acted. She'd acted in a lot of stuff. But she had never done anything with this tone, and she'd never done anything that demanded this much of her emotionally. She's generally cast in very comedic roles, and she's extremely funny. That was actually the key to making it click, was when I think we were just struggling with something. And I said, you know, Petra gets to be funny. And Maine said, oh, wait, really? Cool. And she started to apply her own sensibility to the role. And all of a sudden, it wasn't just funny. It was kind of devastating in between the funny bits. She's an actor. It's just that this was the first time I think so much had been demanded. And I know that she was very, very keen to get it right. And she worked so hard. And all that work is on screen. Like it's a breathtaking performance. To me, she's kind of the emotional linchpin of the film, which, you know, you could say that casting her without reading her for it was insane. But I just knew. I just absolutely knew that she was the right person. And we made, you know, I think one or two minor alterations to the writing, but mostly she took it as it was. And she killed it. She knocked it out of the park.
I would agree with that. I was wondering as well, focusing on the acting, as somebody who's acted yourself, you've done various different things, be it TV, movies, voiceovers, stage acting. Do you feel, doing all that, having all that experience, that it makes it easier for you to direct other actors?
I think that's a double-edged sword. The one thing that being directed has taught me is that every actor has a different language, and you have to learn how to communicate in that language. I mean, for instance, someone like Rosebud, who is breathtaking in the film. Some people like a really technical and precise and blocked out thing. And with Rosebud, what we found worked was creating a space for the performance, because so much of that was spontaneous and of the moment and perfect. And you know, but when it comes to someone like Brian Solomon, he loves a technical direction. He loves knowing, here's where I stand, I move here, I turn my head here. He loves incredibly minute direction, and he'll give you everything. He'll give you a million options, and all of them are going to be great, but he loves being directed. Kristen Vaughn is more or less, she kind of just comes out with everything right. I've actually never seen her do a take where it wasn't correct. And that can lull you into a sense of like, well, I don't need a director, but always direct. You know, don't just leave people to their own devices. Let them know that you see them and you hear them, and get their opinion, get their feedback before you go ahead with it. And with Maine, it was a very sort of intuitive talking through it, you know, sort of process. I mean, everything was taken very moment to moment. And one thing that we did on the film that I think this did come from me being an actor, something that we did on the film was that we would do really, really long takes. You know, there were a lot of scenes where we wouldn't say cut if we had to start again. I would just very gently guide it back to a particular point in the text, and we would keep going, which made editing certainly a little bit more difficult, but I think really, really helped get results on the acting front. Because once you say cut, everything stops. You know, the technical end, the acting end, it's all just done. And you have to rebuild to a certain extent. But as long as you're rolling and you haven't said cut, you actually, you're still under that spell. You're still mesmerized. And it got really lovely. Like, one of my favorite sequences in the film is that it's just three close-ups, the canted angles, the first time that Petra and Olive start talking about, you know, the dactyl and Petra's storytelling history. And with those, we did very few actual takes, but we shot so much material. And you can see, like, a lot of the stuff that we did was from later on in the takes, because they were, Rosebud and Maine and Brian were getting into that zone, getting into that place that you lose when someone says cut, so that they didn't have to artificially build it back up. But as I say, it makes editing an absolute goddamn nightmare, because then you have to scan through, you know, a 10, 15 minute take. But I'm so glad we did it.
I was also wondering, how was it as a learning experience for you? I mean, obviously this is your debut feature. You did, as far as I can see from your credits, you didn't do a short beforehand. A lot of people, before they do their debut feature, do a shorter two. How nervous were you going into it? And how steep was the learning curve across the shoot?
I was very, very nervous. It was, you know, I mean, jumping right into, I had made some shorts. I'd shot some dance shorts, which was where I learned about, you know, the line of movement and certain continuity things. And that was really, and compositional stuff, but I'd never really shot anything fully narrative. But I also didn't have any stories I wanted to tell in the short form. I just wanted to tell a full length story. The learning curve was, I mean, it's funny. I mean, I learned a million things every single day, but there's not really enough time to think about it or worry about it when you're on such a short schedule. You just get in and you start making creative and technical decisions, because they have to get made, and you learn as you go. And I do think that the film is, in the second half, a better shot, better assembled film. I don't think I got as much coverage as I would have liked in the first half for certain things. Like, it's hard for me to watch sometimes the first, like, I'd say like maybe 10 or 12 minutes of the film, because that's where I just didn't shoot enough coverage. And that was when I was really just figuring out what the hell I was doing. But I had, you know, amazing people helping me every single day. You know, I had Patrick Shearer, who has made several films, and he was a fantastic, fantastic artist. And Brian Enck was on set every day. And Christiane Coop, who is Brian's wife and a spectacular person, and did all the art and set direction. You know, they were all just on set, you know, and they were invaluable resources. But for the most part, it's almost a form of improv, because something's going to come up that you have to figure out, and you either figure it out or you stop shooting your movie. And I think the film weirdly benefits from that kind of tap dancing on the edge of disaster feeling.
Was it stressful balancing as many? Well, I mean, you're credited as the director, the cinematographer, editor. Was it difficult balancing all those different roles?
Weirdly, no. I loved shooting while I was directing. That for me was the easiest, funnest stuff, was being right behind the camera, often just a few feet or even inches from the actor's face, and working with them, not sitting back at a monitor. I don't like being far away from it. So the shooting, the cinematography and directing actually kind of relaxed me, because it gave me something to focus on and not just sort of watch it happen. I was intimately involved. And the editing was just a joy. Editing it was my favorite part of any of that.
That is interesting. I have talked quite a few directors on this podcast, and often People have said what a trudge the editing has been. Not everybody, but it seems common.
Oh my gosh, I honestly can't think of anything I loved more than taking that footage and sitting down with it and spending hours just like trying stuff. That was the most fun. And you know, I don't know, man. I don't even know what to say. Like it was one of the highlights of the process, was getting to assemble a cut and then fine tune it. I'll say this, another way Patrick was incredibly useful and brilliant was that when I finished my rough cut of the film, I had cut it so fast. The film you see now is almost 5 minutes longer than the rough cut, which is normally not the thing. Normally you want to take stuff out.
Yeah, absolutely.
And in the case of this, I had cut it so fast that there was nothing to hang on to in the first half. It just went by. And Patrick very brilliantly was like, you need to slow down and you need to isolate what you want people to care about here. Because the emotional through lines are there. It's just that nothing is highlighted because you're moving so fast. And he was right. And so I just went back and put in breathing room. Because I recently, before I hopped on for this interview, I'd looked at the rough cut, and the first half is almost unwatchable because there's no time to think. And it's so much to chew on. It's so much emotional material and there's a lot of exposition. And I think my fear of people getting bored led me to just like cut it at turbo speed. But once we found that breathing room, it was almost magical, you know. And that's, again, Patrick Shearer, amazing.
Yeah, I can imagine that it must be pretty intense if it was short. I mean, for the viewers at home, the finished running time is still only something like 79 minutes.
That's right.
I believe I am correct in saying. So yeah, I can imagine it'd be maybe a little too much.
It's too much all at once. I mean, even at an hour and 19, there is an overwhelming amount of stuff in this movie to absorb. And so imagine that with none of that breathing room. Yeah, no, man. No way. But the editing was the most fun. I loved that. And when you find an edit that really clicks and that really sings, it's the most beautiful, thrilling feeling.
I was wondering also, was it always your desire to direct at some stage in your career?
Yes.
Or did that arrive? Oh, right, so it was.
Yes, because I love movies and I wanted to tell stories. I wanted to make them. The moment you start seeing what a director is doing in a movie, I think it's hard not to want to do it. You know, once you understand why a movie makes you feel a certain way or why a director made a certain decision, you know, when you're watching, I mean, it was, okay, like for me, when I was young, one of the most impactful directors was Spike Lee, because everything he did felt like Spike Lee. And so at a certain point, you have to ask yourself, all right, like, why does it feel that way? What is he doing? What are the choices he's making? How do you make a movie that's so comprehensively you? You know, and I think he's a technical genius and just like, but there are certain trademarks in his films where you're like, nobody could do this but Spike Lee. And so then you start dissecting, okay, well, how and why? And then you start thinking about that in regards to every movie you enjoy. Like, why does that make me feel this way? Why does it shock me or devastate me or make me laugh or leave me with my jaw on the ground? And like, for me, the process of figuring that out and absorbing a ridiculous number of films, because I watch a ridiculous number of films, that led me to just really, really need to do my own. There were stories I knew I wanted to tell, and I wanted to figure out what an Abe Goldfarb movie looked and sounded like.
So how did the journey end up being acting first?
Well, that was, you know, I'd been acting since high school, you know, school plays, and then I went to theater school in the UK at the Bristol Old Vic for 3 years, back from 97 to 2000, and just went back to New York, did a lot of theater, started acting in commercials, started doing cartoon voices, and I was going to make another film, and I kind of got waylaid because I was in the Broadway production of Beetlejuice, which I did not expect.
I was actually planning to ask you about that. That sounded interesting. I was like, oh man, I didn't even know there was a Beetlejuice musical on the stage.
It is awesome. And I figured there was no way I would get it. I really wanted to move on and start making another film, and I was developing scripts with Mac and on my own. and I wound up getting called back to audition for Beetlejuice several times. And I figured there was nothing doing, it just wouldn't pan out. And I was ready to kind of step away from acting on stage in general, because commercials and voiceover were pretty much where I was getting most of my work. And then I pretty much spent 2018 to 2020 working on Beetlejuice. I was in the ensemble and understudying all of the principal men. And it was an amazing experience. That show is awesome. And obviously we got shut down with the rest of Broadway 2 months ago. But yeah, no, it was, if there's a reason that you're going to get torn away from making another movie, I think doing a Beetlejuice musical is about the best one there is.
I definitely think so. That is absolutely awesome.
Yeah, man, it was huge. I'd never worked on anything so big. And I remember when I learned what the budget was, I almost fainted. Because it, of course, the show was directed by the great Alex Timbers, who's a genius. The songs were written by Eddie Perfect, who's a brilliant Australian cabaret performer, singer, songwriter. And the book was written by Anthony King, who is an astounding comedy writer, and Scott Brown, who works on Castle Rock, which a lot of people know and love, the Stephen King TV series. Mm. But there was an interview where they were talking to all the key creatives. And this was when we were doing the show in Washington, D.C. before we came to New York. And Eddie just sort of let it slip that the production had cost $21 million. And I almost had a goddamn heart attack, because the idea of working on something so big, it's unthinkable to me. Our budget for Gallery K, I think, was about $8,000 altogether. And maybe like a couple hundred more here or there, but like it was about $8,000. And so to go from that to acting in something so enormous with like two full-size sandworms and a giant transforming moving set, you know, and an ensemble of, I don't know, 20 people. Like, it was mind-blowing.
The big question is that you said that you're understudying a bunch of the principal male
yes.
characters. So have you played Beetlejuice on stage?
Yes. Well, I didn't go on for Beetlejuice or Adam Maitland or Charles Dietz. And I was ready to go on for all three of them. And it looked as though I was going to before things kind of went sideways. But I'd gone on for Maxie Dean, who in the film is, I think, Robert Goulet, and it's a very brief role. And in the show, he gets a big scene at the end of the first act. So I've gone on for him. And I went on for Otho, who is the most fun, who just gets to roll in act two, you know, do a bunch of funny stuff and then leave. It's, you know, he's sort of there from the middle of act two to the end of the show. And it's an absolute prize of a role. And that was a joy. I loved doing that. And the originals for all of those, for Otho, it was Kelvin Moonlow, who is a staggering musical theater actor, an absolute genius. For Maxie Dean, it was Danny Ritigliano, who has been working in showbiz for a long time. And has done it all and seen it all and has amazing stories. And then for like the big leads, Alex Brightman was Beetlejuice, which his performance for a lot of people is at this point definitive, and it's a brilliant performance. Adam Maitland was Rob McClure, who I can't say enough about, was very much a guru and a guiding light through the process. And Charles Dietz was Adam Danheiser, who is one of the goofiest, funniest, most relaxed people I've ever met in my life. He's a genius. I love them all. And they were long shadows, I think, to stand in. Big shoes to fill.
Well, definitely if and when we come out of lockdown, if it ever transfers over here to the UK.
There are plans. Warner Brothers wants to take it to London. And if you want, you can listen to the soundtrack. It's been streaming for the longest time. Beetlejuice, the musical. It is awesome.
I will check it out.
Yeah, man.
Going back to the horror at Gallery Key,
yeah.
I'm wondering, did you always want to make a horror, and have you always been interested in horror movies?
I've always loved horror films. I don't know if I had an inclination or an itch to make my first film a horror film, but given what Mac wrote, what we came up with, it was just too good not to do. Yeah, I've always loved horror films. I mean, I two of my favorite films of all time, and both of which I saw. This is so strange. Two of my favorite films ever I saw when I was very young with a fever, very unwell. and they've stayed with me for the rest of my life. One of them was Philip Kaufman's Invasion of the Body Snatchers remake with Donald Sutherland and Leonard Nimoy. And the other was John Carpenter's remake of The Thing. And those films, for me, contain everything movies need. Like, those are full 20-course banquets of cinema. And so, yeah, I was never a purposeful gore hound, though I do enjoy a bit of gore in a film. I was just mostly interested in stories that freaked me out, made my mind go to different places, sometimes uncomfortable, awestruck places. And so, yeah, I've long adored horror.
I mean, great choices. I mean, absolutely. The Thing is in my top five horrors for sure.
It is staggering. It's a masterpiece.
It absolutely is. I do wonder, there is maybe films do have a greater impression on you if you see them in your teenage years with a fever. Because I remember the first ever time I saw the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, I saw it at like, I had a fever, I couldn't sleep. I saw it at like 2 o'clock in the morning. I was,
oh my God, that must have been insane.
Oh, it was intense. Like it is an experience that never left me. It is one of my favorite horror movies as well. But like, yes, that is my first memory of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and it was possibly the most intense viewing experience I've ever had.
Like, your brain is boiling, and you're watching this film that's like the closest approximation to like smelling rot on screen. It's a film that just it's like a mold that creeps into you. Oh my God, I can't even imagine seeing that with a fever. That's incredible. And it must leave you with, I mean, it must have left you with a lingering terror.
Oh yeah. Oh
God. Like that last shot of a fucking Leatherface just swinging the goddamn chainsaw around.
Oh yeah.
This is not over. Yeah. And no, all the films all these films that we're talking about have endings that tell you it's not over.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Like the ending of The Thing, which is so magnificently ambiguous, where you don't know if the apocalypse is going to happen. And I mean, the ending of Invasion of the Body Snatchers, where we know that it has.
Yes.
I mean, like that the last shot of Invasion of the Body Snatchers with Donald Sutherland is that I couldn't sleep for days.
Like one of the all-time great cinematic gut punches.
Yes. Oh my God. Anyway, yes. Love horror, always have. And love finding new little wrinkles. I only really started getting into the Italian stuff a couple years ago, like Fulci and Argento and, you know, the old masters. And Michel Soavi, who I really enjoy.
Oh yeah. I mean, like, yeah, I mean, obviously Argento is one of my favorites. A lot of his films are very well known. Suspiria, Deep Red, you know, all stuff. But yeah, Soavi, he's kind of got a lot of underrated movies. A surprising amount of people have not seen the likes of Cemetery Man, which I think.
Yeah. And also The Church, which is an amazing Soavi. I believe that's Soavi. I think The Church is incredible. Very like ambitious and sweeping and strange. And I think it was intended to be the third film in the Demon series. I think the notion was that it was going to be the third installment, and it kind of went off in its own direction and became its own thing. But I love the Demons films. Yeah, no, and that's another example of like, I mean, the Demons films are almost cosmic horror because there's something inexplicable about what's happening in them. Like, you know, there's a vague gesture at like, this is why this stuff is happening. But like, the films operate in a completely different like brain zone.
I do like that though, when there's not like a heavy explanation. It's just like this kind of inexplicable thing. You know, like the Dawn of the Dead thing, you know, when there's room left in hell. And it's like, yeah, that's all the reasoning you're getting.
Yeah, I will take it as read that there was no room left in hell and thus the dead are walking the earth. Like, I accept that. But yeah, no, I absolutely love that when a horror film basically, it works in that way that's like, it's almost subliminal. You just accept the dream logic. I love that. And I think Richard Stanley is kind of a brilliant example of that. know, his stuff works on that almost subliminal level.
And I love things. I think we're talking a lot of things, demons, Saavi, Richard Stanley. I love the kind of weirdness of their movies as well. And there's a touch of that in your movie as well. You know, just like the little touches of, like, you know, we talked earlier about Color Out of Space. You know, Nicolas Cage is farming alpacas because, of course.
Of course he's farming alpacas. Like, I don't know why he wouldn't. No, the film is full of little touches like that. And I think, weirdly, Cage might be the ultimate avatar for what Stanley is up to. You know, I absolutely love... I'm a huge Nicolas Cage fan. I think he's a brilliant actor, and I think a lot of the memeifying of him has cheapened the impact and the artistry of some of his work. He is someone who is not aiming for realism. He's aiming for a larger, stranger truth in his work. There's a great online critic, Outlaw Vern. I don't know if you read Vern.
Yeah, I'm aware of him. Yeah, I have read some of his stuff.
Vern is one of my favorite film writers in the world, and he coined a term for Nicolas Cage, mega acting, which is, he's like, it's not overacting, because overacting means it's improperly scaled to what you're doing. It says what Nicolas Cage is doing is mega acting, where you're just making, like, sincere and intense choices and going in directions that no one else would think to go. And I think Color Out of Space is definitely a film where Nicolas Cage engages in some extraordinary mega acting. Because I had a friend who watched it, who didn't care for it as much as I did, who said, you know, why does he start talking in that ridiculous accent towards the end of the film? And I'm like, because it was his dad's accent. We heard him talk about it at the beginning of the film. And at the end of the film, he said in the beginning, he never wants to become his dad. And by the end of the film, he's become his dad. And I was just like, I was so way into it. And I was like, that's the kind of choice where I'm just like, yes, you're going home. You're doing the reading. You're deciding this is going to enhance the experience. Not just for me, but for everyone watching. I'm a huge Nicolas Cage fan.
I have to say, I am completely aboard this train. I find I spend far too much of my time defending Nicolas Cage. I totally agree. He's a brilliant actor. And I love Cage when he goes full Cage, whether it's in Color Out of Space or Mandy or Kick-Ass or Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans,
yes,
or Raising Arizona or Wild at Heart. You know, the just amazing.
Yes.
Absolutely aboard with you on this.
I'm so glad to hear that. Now, I've been on board the Cage train since Raising Arizona, which is such an odd performance. But, you know, once you've seen it, you literally can't imagine anyone else playing the role. You're like, this is the guy. Absolutely. So, you know, but yeah, I mean, and he's one of those guys who, I mean, he's, how long has he been acting now? Must be like almost 40 years.
Yeah, since maybe the mid-80s or something like that.
It's at least 35 years he's been acting.
Yeah, at least 35.
And that you can be acting for that long and still make choices that surprise me, like, that's incredible. You know, I mean, like, it's just every couple of years. First of all, the guy loves acting. And when people rag on him for just, like, working, you know, he's done some direct-to-video stuff. He's done some films that maybe didn't resonate with me that I wasn't a huge fan of, but he loves to work. That's what actors do. Actors act. And the fact that he does that to keep himself sharp and to find little laboratories to try things, then every couple of years you get something that is genuinely, like, unbelievable, like, out of this world. How did you give that performance? Unironically, love Cage. I hosted and produced a Nicolas Cage-themed burlesque show at one point. It was called Burlesque Uncaged, and it was a bunch of burlesque striptease artists doing homages to the cinema of Nicolas Cage. And I wrote and performed a rap about Nicolas Cage. It was the silliest goddamn thing. But anyway, we're off on a Cage tangent here. I'm just a huge fan.
I was just about to bring us realist back in.
Yes, yes. I'm sorry. Don't get me wrong. I love talking about. Yeah, I love talking about my movie.
I love talking about it as well. But I did want to circle back to your movie, and my segue was going to be talking about making surprising choices. There is a surprising amount of gore in the movie. I don't think that's a spoiler. Did you deliberately set that up as a kind of like, oh shit, this is not the horror I thought it was going to be?
Well, I definitely, there's definitely a sense of like the penny dropping, you know, when you get that first gore gag. I mean, I knew that there had to be a little bit of gore in it because I just thought you need a violent disruption of the status quo, because it's sort of been through the first half of the film, the sense of normality is slowly being encroached upon by these larger, stranger things. And then we needed like a real turning point. And, you know, Mac came up with those gags, the two big gore gags. And honestly, I was just so excited to shoot them. I love practical gore. And I love, I love like plastic molding. I love fake blood. We did like the Hitchcock mixture for blood, you know, chocolate sauce, a little bit of red in it. Mm-hmm. And I was just super duper psyched. The most fun was the second gore gag. I don't want to give it away, but Brian Silliman lying on the floor and something terrible happening to him. And I was just running around him with a camera, spritzing him with blood, just being like, scream, Brian, scream for your life. It was so obscenely fun. That was the day that Mac visited the set. So he got to hang out while we just, oh, poor Brian. Poor Brian Silliman. He really went through it. He was the one who got all this.
One day to visit the set.
Oh yeah. Mac was overjoyed because he was like, man, it's one thing to write such and such happens to this poor guy. He's like, it's another to watch you actually just lay them down on a tarp and do it. And Brian Silliman might be the best sport in modern cinema. We really put him through it with this one. He's very much my Bruce Campbell, who I just torment. But yeah. I'd love to get your feelings on, like, what did the film say to you? What did it mean to you? What was your experience of watching it?
I found it, I mean, it was an unusual experience. There was a lot going on. I thought I had a thread on it. I thought I knew, like, you know, I asked that question because there is like a broadness to it in its second half that I just didn't expect.
First half is pretty buttoned down.
Yeah, it's buttoned down, but like there's like this creeping sense of like horror going on. Like, you know, there's like this kind of emotion to it, but then there's a kind of, you know, there's little touches of comedy, and I was like, okay, there's kind of black humor here, and it's, but I kind of had my peg of it, you know, of what I thought it was going to be. I had my A24 hat on, and I was like, you know, like, this is like, you know, it's
the A24 hat. I classy horror.
You know, like, I'm just, you know, it's true. There's another kind of art house sensibility to it, and I thought that was the kind of creeping dread horror that that's what I was kind of expecting from it. And I certainly wasn't expecting this kind of Sam Raimi aspect that I
The moment that I don't mean to interrupt, but the first screening of it, the place was packed out, and it had been very well received up to that point. But the moment when the gore drops, there was a shriek. People were like hooting. It was such a moment. It was such a turn. But yeah, no, it's, but please go on. I love that turn hits people so hard.
The thing I found most surprising about that was I still enjoyed it. Like, sometimes the, you know, movies can take a hard left turn and it upsets the movie completely.
Well, yeah, it's usually when it doesn't feel germane, you know, to the themes. Like, it definitely, there's definitely movies where there's a swerve in the tonality, where you're like, I get that you're trying to freak me out, but I'm not sure that you've earned it.
Absolutely. And I just think that there's some filmmakers that do it better than others. And I have to say, I've seen it done badly more often in American film.
I think that's fair.
I've noticed that Asian filmmakers, particularly Japanese filmmakers and South Korean filmmakers, actually tend to do it better more often.
I think that American film is often straitjacketed by genre. I think that American film is convention bound in a lot of ways, where there's just a decision about what kind of movie it is, you know. But I'm a huge fan of Hindi filmmaking and Telugu filmmaking. And those are two industries where wild tonal swerves are like just part of the experience. And I've always loved that. I've always loved the idea.
I think it's brilliant when it's done well.
Yes.
It's absolutely, and I think, you know, like, there's filmmakers like, you know, obviously it won the Oscar, Parasite, you know, there's filmmakers like Bong Joon-ho, and there's filmmakers like Takeshi Miike who like can do tonal shifts, several tonal shifts throughout a movie, and it can totally work.
Yeah, I mean, like, one of my favorite movies of all time is a Bollywood musical called Om Shanti Om, which is amazing. It is a romantic comedy, supernatural revenge thriller musical. And it's directed by this fabulous filmmaker, Farah Khan, who makes films that are in the genre known as masala. Masala being like a little bit of everything. And there's a huge turn in the middle of Om Shanti Om. And the first time I watched it, I was so shocked. But then the rest of the film just sort of like picks it up and carries on. And it never feels like, it never feels wrong for the film. And there's something, I think that, there's a kind of film language that tells you to expect the unexpected. And there's a kind of film language that tells you this is what the film is. And I think there's an orthodoxy in American films that is not present in a lot of other film industries around the world.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with that. I mean, like, I highlighted like Japanese and South Korean cinema, but you're right. It's not, they're not the only ones. Unfortunately, I think we could talk movies all night, and this has been great talking to you and great talking to you about Horror at Gallery K. But can you quickly tell us what you're up to next, and then we'll wrap this one up.
Well, I'm afraid that it's hard to say what I'm up to next because I don't know. I don't know when anything's going to open back up because we're still in the middle of this viral outbreak. I'm working on a book right now. I'm writing a book that is, without giving too much away, a kind of pulp crime horror hybrid that still dips into some Lovecraftian stuff. And I mean, other than that, it's just working on scripts for things I can shoot when it's possible to shoot things again. Beetlejuice may yet come back to New York when all this is over. And in the meantime, yeah, I'm just staying alive, staying well, and I certainly hope everyone listening and those that they love are alive and well and in good shape.
Well, we can definitely get on board with that.
Yeah, man.
Sentiment. We certainly hope that all New Horror Express listeners are staying safe and well in their homes.
Yes, please. And if you ever find yourself of an evening antsy and in need of extremely strange entertainment, please please go to Prime Video and watch The Horror at Gallery K. It's my little, it's my weird, surreal, gay blood baby. I love it so much.
Absolutely. Well, we recommend that listeners absolutely go and do that. So it's been an absolute delight to have you on for this episode, Abe. Thank you very much. And come on again whenever something else arises.
I would love that. Thank you so much for talking.
That was my guest, Abe, there, who I'd like to thank once again for coming on the show. And as mentioned, if you want to check out The Horror Gallery K, you can do on Prime Video. Also, I'd like to thank you, listener, for tuning in to this latest episode of New Horror Express. And if you like what you heard, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. Well, that's all for this time, but be sure to join us again in 2 weeks' time when I shall be talking to another great guest from the world of indie horror. Until then, though, see ya!